We're all right.
Okay, moving along. Next up is Roberta F. Schwartz. She is currently director of the Archive of Recorded Sound at University of Kansas and assistant professor of historical musicology. She became a member of the faculty at KU in 2001, got her bachelor's of music and master's of music history and literature at the University of Iowa, and a PhD in musicology from University of Illinois. Her interests range widely. from music of the Renaissance, Spanish music, and also what we're going to hear today, African-American urban popular music. She's got a forthcoming journal article on this called To Get My Ham Bone Boiled, Food as Sexual Euphemism in the Blues. We'll also be hearing about the blues today and questions of authenticity like we've been... We've just been talking about questions about things.
Well, thanks for sticking around. This will also be, I apologize, extremely low tech. I'm just going to read something. And I'm also going to be talking about Britain. So again, sorry. The Congressional Declaration of 2003 is the year of the blues, generated a miniseries, memorial concerts, symposia, and also some debate about the health of the genre. The most public articulation of this sentiment was an article published in Mother Jones magazine entitled Who's Got the Blues? Arthur David Hadju asserts that the blues have become a feel-good soundtrack for white America, and argues that the commercial popularity of the blues has compromised its authenticity and forces a serious expression of African-American culture. This argument raises a number of interesting questions, not the least of which is who's more culpable in appropriating the blues, the musicians and audiences who've embraced the blues in its commercial format, or those who do enshrine them as pure, untainted expressions of black folk culture. However, what was most striking to me was the familiarity of Hadju's thesis. Quote, whose music is the blues? Is traditional blues still an important part of African American life? Or has the music, like so many black creations, been co-opted by white America and corrupted in the process? How did the blues, a serious form of expression rooted in the hard life of a marginalized people, become a good time music for moneyed tourists, unquote. I felt as if I'd heard these same questions before. And in fact, I had in an article written 40 years earlier, and I quote, it is a sad thing, but the moment any art form becomes popular, more often than not, artistry dies, for commercial pressure nearly always forces the performer to compromise. With blues singers, the problem is a big one. With the growing interest among white audiences, there is a pure to watered-down form, which for want of a better term, let me call pop blues, mere travesties of the real thing. The temptation for genuine blues artists to earn good money after years of near poverty must be almost irresistible, and it's easy to criticize. However, we've seen what can happen to good blues men who have managed to achieve a modicum of popularity with the masses, unquote. Derek Stewart Baxter, writing in the British periodical Jazz Journal in the summer of 1963, was referring to the new popularity of rhythm and blues in England. But this was not the first articulation of concern for the welfare of the blues. In Britain, beginning in the late 1940s and continuing through the British blues revival of the 1960s, critics, fans, and artists filled the pages of jazz and blues journals with discussions about commercialization, authenticity, emotional expression, and racial identity, and which artists and styles represented the real blues. In order to gain some perspective on this idea of authenticity in blues discourse, this paper will provide a quick history of authenticity in British writing about blues recordings, catalog the central arguments expressed, and address some of the common themes. Authenticity is a loosely defined but pretty persistent idea that factors in many debates about the appropriation and commodification of folk music and non-Western musics. In his Philosophy of Music, Theodor Adorno modified a concept originating with the German existentialist movement and used authenticity to describe works that, quote, forge their own internal consistency while acknowledging the historical nature and social function of the material. However, authenticity mostly evaluates the ability of music, generally from a non-European tradition, to conform to an idealized notion of reality, how we imagine the music ought to sound, its credibility and its lack of artifice. The concept of an authentic form of African-American music seems to have emerged in both the United States and the United Kingdom in response to the sweet dance band arrangements of jazz that came to dominate the popular music market in the 1920s. By the late 1930s, a subset of British jazz fans had embraced recordings of black American jazz, as opposed to inauthentic imitations of British dance bands, as examples of a folk art untainted by commercial concerns. Their numbers grew after World War II, when not only swing, but this strange new American jazz that they called rebop seemed to be threatening true hot jazz. A segment of New Orleans revivalists, known in England as Moldy Figs, thought that the cure for the decadence and sterility of modern jazz was a return to its roots in the blues. Certainly, American writers such as Ernest Borneman and Mez Mesro possess similar views. However, in the United Kingdom, the effort focused most intently on creating exposure for African-American folk music. Jazz Music was the first publication in England devoted to increasing knowledge and circulation of African-American recordings. Editorials and content focused not only on the musical roots of jazz, but also the superiority of black musicians and the role that racism and social conditions had played in the inception of the genre. The magazine also highlighted the corrosive effect of commercial pressures on the black folk tradition. In searching for a type of African-American music that still retained some of the authenticity of original jazz, the British jazz revival embraced black musicians associated with the New York folk movement. First Leadbelly, then Josh White, were enthusiastically embraced as the real thing, perhaps the last performers of the authentic blues. The recordings were praised as, quote, honest, unpretentious, unselfconscious, and uncommercial, despite a trained and tasteful presentation that, at least in White's case, had to be rationalized as still containing, quote, the emotion and sensuality that characterized the true singing of the blues. Enthusiasm for these performers waned only upon the arrival in Britain of the recordings of Big Bill Brunsey, whose style seemed more earthy and connected to the authentic Southern tradition. Other artists were similarly embraced and recommended, regardless of the quality of their material. Even weak performers were defended on the basis of their value as real blues singers, which, quote, compensates for a certain monotony in their songs, unquote. Some musicians also used authenticity as a marketing device. Brunsey never bothered to correct assumptions by British blues writers that he was, quote, the only blues singer of the old school left today, unquote. In fact, he sold himself as the sound of the real blues. Quote, these fellas singing folk music in the nightclubs and with the dance bands, well, they're all right, but they're not real blues, unquote. The desire to hear authentic black music colored the reception of other blues styles. Several well-known musicians who had enjoyed moderate popularity in the United States were less than successful in the United Kingdom because their amplified electric style didn't match previously established ideas of what the real blues were. Worse, it sounded suspiciously like rock and roll. This led to some blues acts touring in Britain to play in a conservative and outmoded style. Muddy Waters was one who was willing to tailor his performance to the desires of the audience. He told reporter Max Jones, quote, now that I know that people in England like soft guitar and old blues, next time I come, I'll learn some old songs first, unquote. Reaction to the blues was particularly conflicted during the years 1958 and 1964. Increased familiarity with the amplified blues allowed for their acceptance as authentic black music, but performers were often condemned for their, quote, slick professionalism, unquote. It was the oldest British adherents of the blues, ironically, who were the staunchest defenders of new styles. Said Albert McCarthy, quote, the public for genuine blues items is growing, which is all to the good, but concurrent with it, there is emerging a type of purism that's extremely undesirable. It should be no secret that most of the outstanding contemporary blues singers prefer using an electric guitar and featuring backing that's sometimes classified as rock and roll. I'm now hearing of instances where singers are being asked to record for a specialist white collector market on condition that they use an acoustic guitar and cut down on backing to one considered more genuine. I'm sure that if these blues followers were to hear Howlin' Wolf or Muddy Waters playing to their own audiences in Chicago nightclubs, they'd consider them renegades, unquote. At the same time, rhythm and blues had come to occupy for many young listeners the authenticity void left by the increasingly commercial slant of revival or trad jazz and the British rock and roll machine. However, artists and even albums had to be evaluated on a case-by-case basis, as there was no agreement on what constituted the authentic style. Unacknowledged post-war blues singers generally qualify. Thus, J.B. Lenore and Eddie Taylor were considered more authentic than Bo Diddley and Arthur Alexander. Pre-war blues were nearly always accepted as the real thing, though female classic blues singers, unless they were Bessie Smith or Ma Rainey, were considered too commercially oriented and jazz-affiliated to qualify. Emotional expression was often of primary importance in determining the authenticity of a performer. Albert McCarthy stated, quote, "The impact of a good blues singer is partly that he or she gives a feeling of involvement with his or her material. An outstanding present-day performer like Lightnin' Hopkins convinces one by the virtue of the fact that he never falls into the error of false attitudinizing. It's the very casualness of comment on so many blues singers, on so many blues records that gives it the ring of truth," unquote. The debate over authenticity exploded in 1964 when British R&B, in quotes, previously a minority segment of the trad jazz revival, vaulted into mainstream popularity, and the house bands of many small blues clubs in London, the Rolling Stones, the Yardbirds, the Animals, and many others, began climbing the pop charts. Within weeks, the letter columns of Britain's jazz and nascent blues periodicals became discussion forums. These exchanges encompassed a full range of questions dealing with the essential nature and the meaning of the blues. Almost no one considered British R&B, a phrase considered so problematic that it rarely appeared in the jazz or blues press without being safely sheathed in quotation marks, lest the author be considered some sort of rock and roll sympathizer. Nobody considered that to be the real blues. To be fair, the vast majority of said blues bands would have agreed. Virtually none claimed to be playing the genuine article, and if they did, they admitted that they did so badly and only to stimulate an audience for recordings of the real thing. However, their commercial success raised accusations of appropriation of traditional black material to the detriment of their original creators. American blues artists, however, were mostly supportive, and many, though not all, of their British protégés were careful to ensure both recognition and royalties for musicians whose songs they covered. Many black musicians, who found their popularity waning in the U.S., enjoyed revitalized careers, though they were occasionally uncomfortable with the source of their newfound recognition. Muddy Waters said, quote, "I thinks to myself how these white kids was sitting down and thinking and playing the blues that my black kids was bypassing. That was a hell of a thing, man, to think about." A segment of the blues intelligentsia opposed any white performances of the blues. Particularly worrisome were the vocal quality of many young singers, young Englishmen trying to sing, quote, like Mississippi farmhands, and the lack of any relationship to the material. Quote, "Like you'd expect, most of our homegrown blues singers were lousy. They'd come out of Surbiton, and they'd sing their blues, dem laudy-laudy blues, all about the cotton fields back home, the Dagenham Delta," unquote. In 1965, a favorable review of a Canned Heat LP in the British blues periodical Blues Unlimited touched off a related debate. Can white men sing the blues? In response to a suggestion that a white band could produce credible blues, the periodical received 25 letters with 21 firmly opposed to white blues performers. One writer commented, quote, "Authenticity is of more value to me than mere virtuosity. It's difficult to answer the question, can a white man sing the blues? A white man playing blues is like a dog walking on his hind legs. The wonder is not that he does it very well, but that he does it at all," unquote. Muddy Waters, for his part, agreed. Quote, "These young white kids are playing in the old style. Now, maybe they feel the blues like I do, and maybe they can play like I do, but they can't sing like I do," unquote. Some respondents suggested it might be acceptable to like both the black originators and the white imitators, but these were clearly a minority. At the same time, self-proclaimed purists, a younger generation of fans who sought authenticity in the recordings of country blues artists in the 1920s and 30s, were equally critical of black American blues artists. A typical example, Charles Radcliffe, writing in 1965, judged Muddy Waters, quote, "an exciting stage act rather than authentic blues," unquote, and his music a commercialized alteration of what must have once been a genuine style. Radcliffe was similarly critical of John Lee Hooker, judging only his early earthy blues to be great. In concert, he noted white audiences got folk-tinged blues and black audiences, quote, "highly rhythmic boogie numbers," unquote, but neither does he consider really authentic. Similarly, it was feared that Junior Wells, Buddy Guy, and other prominent Chicago blues players had become too slick and too sophisticated to be considered real bluesmen. Increasingly, reviews of records by modern performers like B.B. King evinced a sense of bitter betrayal, and the death of the blues was predicted with increasing frequency. Paul Oliver expressed his surprise as, quote, "blues lovers are so ready to cry phony if a city blues singer puts down his electric guitar and plays acoustic for the folk market. The problem, as he saw it, where the touring blues acts were, in fact, quote, too authentic for most of us. Blues is still a living entertainment in the USA. Gimmicks, novelty numbers, simple humor, and vibrant guitars are what customers pay for. I see no reason why a blues singer should be condemned to moan 13 and a half bars over a tonic chord for the sake of some folksy European romantics, unquote. In the mid-1960s, there were still enough of said romantics to create a demand for authentic blues, though these were now evaluated by increasingly stringent criteria. Charles Keel compiled a list of what seemed from the writing of English blues authors to be required. The performer must be old, at least 60, obscure, have played with or been taught by a legendary blues man, made only a few records, lived most of his life as a sharecropper or farmer, and been uncontaminated by city influences. Hence, the endorsement of recently discovered artists like Sun House, Fred McDowell, and Mississippi John Hurt, who'd been safely out of circulation since the 1930s, or, optimally, someone like Robert Pete Williams, whose lengthy term of incarceration in Folsom prison had, quote, obviously made him a very much better blues singer, unsullied as he is by the demands of the arty folk world and the demoniacal commercialism of the rock and rollers playing down to white audiences. Williams is a real blues singer, conveying with his earthy voice a fervor and urgency with which most contemporary blues singers seem to have lost, probably for the above reasons. As the 60s drew to a close there was a gradual abandonment of the idealization of the authentic among Britain's jazz and blues constituencies. Roland Atkins suggested that after several waves of deliberately archaic movements catering to consumer demands, quote, we should be rather grateful for any band that is not authentic, unquote. The various English factions made some effort to find common ground and accepted that in an expanded marketplace, there was room for a number of different kinds of blues, even if some were not the genuine article. Moreover, as Richard Middleton observes, quote, the very conditions of the cultural economy were bringing into question any sense of authenticity, even though many musicians and fans still cling to a belief in that concept. The central arguments of the authenticity debate in Britain can be reduced to two broad categories, which are still really central to blues discourse: blues as racial expression and the commercialization of the genre. A portion of the authenticity debate has focused on what Albert Murray suggests is mistaking having the blues for blues music. Alan Lomax was the first in the British press to comment on the disparity between the preferred repertoire of skiffle groups, kind of an amalgamation of rock and roll and country blues, their preferred repertoire of blues and Negro prison songs, and its performers, quite, quote, young white men who had suffered, comparatively speaking, so very little, unquote. Murray has strongly contested the assertion that suffering is the currency of the blues, quote, to the extent that references to singing the blues have come to suggest crying over misfortune, there's also likely to be the implication that blues music does not require artifice, but rather is a species of direct emotional expression in the raw, a natural outpouring of the personal anxiety and anguish which ignores what a blues performance so obviously is. It is precisely an artful contrivance designed for entertainment and aesthetic gratification. And its effectiveness depends on the mastery by one means or another of fundamentals of the craft of music in general and a special sensitivity to the nuances of the idiom in particular, unquote. However, the notion of suffering is also evoked in other contexts. Both David Hadju and Derek Stewart Baxter, from those opening quotes, expressed concern that the music of an oppressed people was being diluted by commercial white interest. The idea that blues carry an inherent component of deep-seated and a deep-seated expression of racial consciousness is one that lies near the center of the authenticity debate. Amiri Baraka, writing as Leroy Jones, has argued that the blues automatically retain certain cultural meanings that are preserved within the music, and these messages are either lost or deliberately obfuscated when performed by whites. However, there's no universal agreement on this idea. Albert Murray has taken Hugh's Panacea to task for stating that the blues are political and racial expressions of oppression. Quote, this emphasis is not borne out by any outstanding internal evidence. His characterization of blues music as protest against the sad lot that was inflicted on him is gratuitous for all its unquestionably good intentions, unquote. In 1960s Britain, cultural imperialism and improper appropriation of cultural capital had yet to be framed really as a separate issue from this idea that the blues were or were not exclusive expressions of African American culture. Appropriation remains an idea that is difficult to debate, as the subject is sometimes complicated by the shifting tastes of the very culture to which ownership is often assigned. The thesis proposed by Baraka, that appropriated forms drive out older, more established ones and drive blacks away from their own music, was demonstrably untrue by the 1960s. Black audiences, especially the younger generation, had largely abandoned the blues in favor of newer styles of black popular music. This shift is not only attributable to changing tastes, but also, according to Isaac Hayes, who I'm glad to see get two mentions this morning, associations with, quote, plantation darky stuff. And that was miles from where we wanted to be, unquote. Muddy Waters frequently commented on the declining popularity of the blues within African American society and believed that the blues would die out with his generation. So it can be argued that white appropriation of the blues kept the genre alive when black consumers and audiences chose newer styles of music. Both Waters and B.B. King struggled with this idea for quite some time, too much of a time limitation to go into their many quotes on the subject. David Hadju's thesis statement reduces this complicated process to an either-or proposition. Are the traditional blues still an important part of African-American culture, or has the music been co-opted by white America? It's an either-or, nothing in between. Theodore Gracek asserts, quote, it can be very difficult to distinguish the homogenization that comes from swamping by another culture from loss that comes about due to choices within the community. African Americans, he says, have no special rights to the blues. If the blues fell out of favor when newer styles like Motown, soul, and funk supplanted the blues tradition within the African American community, unquote. Another complicating factor is the role of recordings in making repertoires and techniques widely available to an indeterminate audience. Richard Middleton has asserted that recordings really threaten the idea of connections between certain styles in their communities, and it makes the idea of social ownership very difficult to protect. The application of racial criteria to a performance, can white men sing the blues, is in some ways a summation of all the other questions about appropriation and identity. It's telling, I think, these issues emerge right around 1965 as white blues and blues rock bands began achieving commercial popularity, and black nationalism and the struggle for civil rights in the United States brought African-American culture and the appropriation of their traditions really into the fore. It's also extremely interesting to me that modern opinion regarding this issue, can white men sing the blues, is diametrically opposed to audiences in 1965. In response to a 1990 guest editorial by Lawrence Hoffman in Guitar Player magazine, which asserted that white blues players could never be more than, quote, convincing expressive copyists, unquote, the magazine received a flood of mail, 95% of which was opposed to the proposition, while only 5% agreed. However, in his ethnographic study of blues clubs in Chicago, David Gracian discovered that white modern audiences who patronize contemporary blues clubs expect to be entertained by black singers and musicians, and they automatically question the authenticity of the product if even part of the band is white. A central premise of the authenticity debate is that there is a single evolutionary trajectory that proves that preserves the authenticity of the original form, and that all others have in some way violated the traditional blues. As blues musicians do, and always have, incorporated influences from other popular styles, trying to identify one true form of the blues seems rather difficult, if not completely impossible. As Gracek has pointed out, quote, living culture is a very, very messy thing. So messy, in fact, that any distinction between pure and polluted cultural forms reflects little more than the taste of the theorists who make the distinction, unquote. Of course, British concerns about the legitimacy of different artisan blues styles was that a commercialized dilution of the music would end up replacing authentic African-American expression with similar but inferior music. Concerns about the commercialization and commodification of the blues have ruled much of the central discourse about the genre. The authentic blues were initially regarded as a folk art that could only be corrupted by the demands of the marketplace. To many British critics, the tragedy of the blues was the commodification of what had once been an untainted form of expression. However, the proposition that the blues have been corrupted by commercial forces assumes that the blues weren't commercial to begin with. For most of us, the folk blues are a chimera. We've heard of them, but our experiences with the authentic blues are on recordings. And once something is recorded, it becomes a commodity. One circulating in new contexts and to new audiences and subject to all kinds of commercial pressures. Some commentators have maintained that blues musicians should resist the demands of the marketplace, as did Ralph Gleason, who stated that only black music with no commercial appeal, free jazz and primitive country blues, could be considered authentic. Charles Shar Murray has asserted in response, quote, "It is hard to avoid the conclusion that this obsession with white pundits, the obsession of white pundits with rootsy, funky, and authentic brings. Blacks, it seemed, have a bounden duty to maintain themselves in a state of poverty and primitivism so as not to jeopardize their status as art objects. It is a duty to stay poor, stay oppressed, to stay funky, stay ignorant, and remain as sufferers in perpetuity," unquote. While not stated in the same way, it does seem that some fears about white consumption of the blues are similarly rooted. For black artists to yield to the commercial pressures of the new marketplace is somehow considered unseemly and betrays the authenticity of their cultural heritage. Yet, the very notion of authenticity itself is a commodity, one that is often manufactured. Big Bill Brunsey traded on his authentic status in Europe in the mid-1950s, as did other African-American artists possessing a repertoire of black folk material. Today, blues clubs in Chicago, St. Louis, and other urban centers associated with the genre offer their visitors to varying degrees of authenticity, from the House of Blues, oriented toward the very casual tourist, to small local clubs that offer a more genuine atmosphere. Musicians in both environments generally play a homogenized repertoire of popular blues standards and cater to the expectations of the mostly white crowds seeking an authentic blues experience. The desire for authenticity, then and now, is related to both social and commercial forces. In 1950s Britain, the new affluent society and classless culture promised by post-war government had revealed itself as merely a middle-class homogenization created by conspicuous consumption and pop culture. Against this backdrop, there was a need for music that seemed non-commercial and halfway honest. Today, similar conditions exist, and to many, the blues symbolize authenticity in a world of globalization and mass-produced pop culture. Part of the desire for authentic, non-commercialized blues, then, is really a longing for a time when music was created for and appealed to more localized audiences. However, the search for authenticity is ultimately a failing prospect, except for on recordings, which Jed Brasila has described as, quote, "technological mediations of an authenticity that is otherwise unavailable," unquote. Certainly, a good deal of contention about whose are the blues and the appropriateness of their use deals with variegated ideas about what they are. There's always been a segment of the blues audience that has viewed the blues as a serious expression of the black race. One of David Hadju's central concerns is that the blues have become commodified as, quote, "feel-good music," unquote. The director of the San Francisco Blues Festival agrees. Quote, "It became kind of a boogie thing, a good time, let's have a party. I really feel that the blues has gotten away from what the music is supposed to be about," unquote. This parallels a 1965 article by Charles Radcliffe, who feared that the music was becoming, quote, increasingly less relevant to the audience for which it is intended," unquote. However, this attitude predisposes what it is appropriate for the blues to express and who it is appropriate for them to express. Despite the original role of the blues in African American culture and society as dance music, and Albert Murray's reminder that the blues is and always has been, quote, "good time music," unquote, there are still constituencies who feel that the music must conform to a single stylistic model or else it is inauthentic. Consumers of authenticity in the blues, as long as they're willing to put their money down, will probably be able to find product for the foreseeable future. As to accusations that the blues are homogenized and less relevant now than they used to be, as long as authenticity survives in recorded form, models for renewal of the blues exist. Nearly 40 years ago, Big Joe Turner explained his reaction to rock and roll and folk authenticity to a British periodical, and I think that his comment applies equally well to the blues today. Quote, "That's all trends. They come and go. Seems like every 20 years the world jumps off and gets happy. You just gotta be there when it jumps." Thank you.
Do we have any quick questions?
There's one.
Oh, you don't need mic.
Not so much a question as a comment. I enjoyed your paper very much.
Thanks.
Certainly you might know of this. In the 1990s, when Sister Marie Cairo, who is an Arabic singer of Arabic Christian music, her first disc came out, which featured a very austere and kind of clear-eyed photograph of herself on the front, Harmonia Mundi, the company, discovered that one of the reasons it was selling so well is because a lot of the people who bought it got an air of authenticity from the photograph, even though the music she was singing, this Persian Christian music, comes from sources that are text only, and mm-hmm. so all of the music was interpretive and thus inauthentic.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, that's your turn. I do need a microphone. My impression, it was an excellent talk.
Thank you.
Very good, very, very good. But I wonder if the questions of agency comes up in this, is if the blues performers have no agency. That is to say, they don't, the white folks define what the music is, and if you don't do the music that way, you're not authentic. Mm-hmm. But what about the agency of the performer? The performer is able to play in any style they want to and find an audience. Now, if that
exactly.
audience is three people in a show, that's fine. If the audience is at the Apollo Theater, that's fine. If the audience is in Royal Albert Hall, that's fine. So what about the agency of the performer? We hear about the critics, but what about the players?
Certainly, I didn't have time to address that. Hopefully, some of that came through sort of by default. Obviously, I'm a big fan of Albert Murray, who's writings have really brought this idea to my attention some years ago, that blues musicians can choose for commercial reasons to, you know, fulfill consumer demand, and lots of them do and are making a very good living. I really recommend this book by David Gracie and Blue Chicago. Has nothing to do with recordings, I will warn you, but if you're at all interested in this idea, it's a sociological study of blues clubs in Chicago and really covers a lot of these issues. And there, you know, are an awful lot of the particularly African-American musicians in Chicago who would rather play in these downtown kind of commercial venues because they make a lot more money. And they say, hey, you know, all right, maybe this isn't the most creative thing that I could be doing, but making a good living. And as a musician, certainly, that's what the ultimate aim of an awful lot of folks.
Oh, okay. That musicians don't usually give themselves the labels. I don't mean like record labels. I mean the labels of what they're doing. They just play music.
Oh, sure. Yeah, it's the critics. And even most of the African-American performers, there's a little bit of conflicting traffic. And one of the things that I'm sort of trying to figure out right now, almost every African-American musician who was playing in England during the 1960s, whose songs were being covered by the Rolling Stones, the Animals, et cetera, they have no problem with it. You know, if they can take my song and, you know, make $1 million, great. You know, as long as they're getting paid as well. We're pretty supportive of efforts. With some then comments by Muddy Waters and some other blues players that indicate that they might have had a problem with it on a certain level, but at least their public persona was very supportive. Let's all make good music. And if it's based on African-American culture and you learn something about it, fantastic. Yeah. Thank you. Sure, I'm blanking right now on who said it, but at least one prominent blues writer has said that the 1980s really are the first generation in which black and white players of the music are on a level playing field because nobody has these old sort of rooted Southern traditions in common anymore, or at least it's very, very rare that everybody's learning to play from records. And that's, I think, a pretty interesting idea, one I'm not sure I entirely agree with, but definitely think should be out there. Yes?
I also wanted to say, as you probably know, there's a similar debate going on with the origins of flamenco music.
Oh, yeah. I know the debate. Know the debate very well. Pardon me? Uh-huh. Oh, sure. This whole idea of authenticity. I mean, not even, you know, getting into the sort of Western art music idea of authentic interpretations, which we're not even trying to use that word anymore. It's so problematic. So yeah, authenticity is something I found very fascinating, sort of stumbling into it while looking at old British blues records, really.